When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Niler 9 podcast. It is the podcast all about music and deep dives into albums we love, music we love, things that we are interested in the field of recorded music. Of course, it is myself, Niler 9, and Andrea Cleary is here, of course. How are you, Andrea?
I'm good, Niall. How are you?
Good, thank you, thank you. So this episode is a deep dive special into an album we are going to be presenting as part of our Listen Closely series in The Big Romance. So if you've not been to The Big Romance, or you have, you will maybe you've even heard about Toby Hatchett's sound system, the lovely warm vinyl analog system that is there in the back room on Parnell Street in Dublin. And Listen Closely, this will be our fourth Listen Closely series. In conjunction with The Big Romance, myself and Andrea present a series of listening parties featuring a focus album from an artist we love or an album we love on the last Wednesday of every month. So the next one is February 28th at The Big Romance. And that album is, Andrea?
Laurie Anderson's Big Science.
That's 1982's album, Big Science by Laurie Anderson. It is Andrea's choice. We're going to talk about why we're going to play this album in full and give it a bit of a spotlight on it. I've only listened to this album once so far, so I will have very little to say about it, but I am familiar with, you know, the big hit from this album is Oh Superman, as in, and it's not a hit is probably the wrong word. It's not really a pop song. It's a quite avant-garde, weird track, but it got quite popular as well. But we're going to delve a bit more into what happens around this album, where Laurie Anderson arrives at Big Science and how it makes sense. So, Andre, you picked this one. So, I mean, let's talk about the basics about why we, for the Listen Closely series so far, we've done, last month we did Mad Villain, Mad Villainy, we did Fortet Rounds in December, Sufjan Stevens, Illinois. That was 2003, 2004, 2005. We've gone back to 1982, the year of my birth here. So what is it about this album, in as an introduction, why did you pick this one?
So I chose this one. I mean, we can tell from the artists that we've done so far, we have focused on three men so far. Not by design or anything. We do have a kind of a balance in this, but it just worked out that thematically these three men came first. So as our first woman as part of the Listen Closely series, I'm really happy that it's Laurie Anderson who I think, I mean, I chose this album number one because I think it is a pioneering work. I think it is a modern classic album. I think it's an album that not many people can find a lot of time to dedicate to sitting down and actually listening to. So I think the environment of the Listen Closely sessions would be really quite ideal to experience this album. It's not an album I've personally experienced collectively with other people. These aren't songs that you hear on a night out or anything like that. So I think that sort of communal dynamic to it will be really, really interesting, because it is actually an album that when listened to while you're isolated or in your headphones can really bring up a lot of emotion and feeling. And I think that that will be a really interesting thing to kind of happen in the room with other people, especially if you are, as I really suggest you do, bringing along somebody who hasn't heard this record. I'd be really interested to know what that experience is like for a first timer. And it is, as I said, a modern classic. Laurie Anderson is a pioneer of, you know, not just music and music technology, but within performance art spaces, within film, within composition more broadly. She is an inventor, a musician, a film director, an artist, a sculptor, a composer. She's, you know, she said that she used to refer to herself as a multimedia artist, but then she found that term a bit clunky or not a not very elegant term to describe what it is that she's trying to do. So she describes herself now as a storyteller, and whatever medium that story kind of calls for is the one that she reaches for. So Laurie Anderson, she is a master of, you know, bringing these seemingly like disparate aesthetic elements of different medias together in her installations, in her practices. She's experimented with, you know, tape loops and recording technologies, synthesizers, vocoders, and sampling technology in the 1970s and the 1980s. She was never really bound by one form of media and engages very much with themes around like mass media culture, and questions about the distinction between high and low culture, high and low art. And you get the impression that she is using whatever is available to her at the time throughout her career. So she has lived kind of multiple lives as multiple artists, but it all kind of comes together to form one oeuvre, to form one kind of artistic life. And for 1982's Big Science, the medium was music. So, you know, it's her first, it's considered to be her debut album, although that is complicated by various works that she's, various musical works that she's engaged with in the past. But in terms of the recording industry, this is considered her first album. So, I mean, to go back earlier in her life, as a child, she was trained in the violin. But around the age of 16, she started to pursue other interests. She wanted to be a writer. Something that she enjoyed doing as a child was climbing a tree and observing the world from a different angle and trying to write stories while she's up there. And she actually quite enjoyed climbing trees as an adult as well. And she began kind of writing and working in other mediums, in painting and art and sculptures. And she says she chose not to play, meaning the violin. It's one of the few things in my life that I'm proud of, that I actually had the foresight to know that I didn't want to do that. So she was a very creative child. She was a very, I think, ambitious child. I was reading this story about her running for class president, I think in high school, and she wrote to John F. Kennedy to ask him for advice on how she should run her campaign. And either him or his campaign responded to her. She won the class presidency. And then she wrote back to him to let him know that she had won the class presidency. And he sent her back a card that said congratulations and I think a dozen roses or something. And it was in her local newspaper. You can see the headline. I found like a picture of the headline. It was like local girl gets letter from president or something like that. So she's, you know, very ambitious. Like the things like boundaries, they don't seem to be things that kind of occur to her. If she wants advice about how to win class presidency, then who better to ask than the president himself, you know? And I mean, generally, there was this profile of Anderson written by a writer called A.M. Holmes, which was really good, in which he called her a cultural historian, an explorer of ideas, big and small. And I think that that's a really good way to describe her. She's so much more than an artist. She's so much more than a musician. You know, she is truly avant-garde. She's truly innovative and pioneering in what it is that she did. So I'm not going to focus too much on kind of her biography in this episode. I know in the past I have, but I think there's so many different strands to Laurie that it's very difficult to go chronologically through her life. And I think, like, for me, my background with this album is I hosted, it may return at some stage, a different podcast called My Favorite Album. And I invited friend of the show, DJ Claire Beck, onto that podcast. And she chose as her favorite album, Big Science by Laurie Anderson. And I had never heard this album before. It was very much my first experience with Laurie. I'd never even heard Oh Superman. So I came into it completely fresh. And so that's my background with this album. It is, you know, relatively new to me. I mean, I think we recorded that episode. It was during, you know, the COVID times, but I think maybe 2021-ish, we recorded that conversation. And I went back and listened to it today. And I found that a lot of the notes I was making for today, or a lot of the themes that I wanted to talk about today, were very present in that conversation with Claire, around anxieties around technology and technology as a mother figure and femininity and technology. Like, these were ideas that were kind of percolating in my mind, and they've had, you know, 3 to 4 years of repeated listening and reading and you know, just understanding. And I think that I wouldn't say I'm close to understanding this record, but my opinions and my thoughts about it are a bit further on than they were. But also, you know, I think the immediacy of the record is the important thing. So, I mean, yeah, I guess before jumping into it, like, you listened to it for the first time in full very recently. Like, how did that
this
go
week,
for you?
Yeah, I'd never heard it before in full. It was one of those albums that I'd heard of. I know Oh Superman as a song. I actually, funny you mentioned that, I do know a kind of a DJ edit version of Oh Superman, which mixes it with one of my favorite Italo songs, actually. It does have some pedigree for a dance floor, surprisingly. But in a way, maybe not that surprising, because it's the kind of song that is an avant-garde kind of funny, like, it's got a life of its own beyond this album, I think, as well. It was quite influential. It sounds, even now, it sounds really like future facing and forward facing and very present and very, like, it's such a cool track. It's such a different kind of song. But other than that, I hadn't really known anything else about this album, and yeah, I was excited, and I was surprised, actually. I thought it was more, this is an electronic, kind of early electronic, kind of classic, kind of weird album, and it's definitely more varied than that. It's got a lot more going on musically. For a song, I was especially surprised by, because I hadn't heard that before. Yeah, there's lots, it's very much, I think the background really helps when you read about it afterwards, and like, it coming from the art piece and the multimedia background and all that kind of stuff, and how it, like, has obviously informed this music, and it feels like this cool, weird soundtrack to a kind of an art gallery piece, you know, so like, it is that multimedia performance piece. So that's all I really knew about it, but yeah, super, super interesting album, and very well produced, very interesting production throughout.
Yeah, so I mean, so to talk about this album, Big Science, we first have to talk about United States 1-4, which is Anderson's 7-hour multimedia performance that used some work from earlier performances. It combined film, photography, drawings, projections, and music in 4 different parts: transportation, politics, money, and love. And this piece has been released as an album. It is available as an album. It was first performed in 1983 at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and she toured with it in London and Zurich as well. And one critic, Rosalie Goldberg, praised it as being both highly inventive and highly accessible to mainstream audiences. She says she crosses from avant-garde obscurity into the so-called mainstream without compromising her ideas or aesthetic integrity, and that this would ensure the performance's continued significance in the annals of art history. So we're talking kind of more than just music history, more than just music technology history. It is the history of art that we're talking about here. And art and the art world is something that is very much part of Anderson's own kind of personal history. She studied art history in New York, and then she studied visual arts for a year, where she started experimenting with painting and sculpting. And then in the early 70s, she graduated and started teaching art and working as an art critic for various magazines and an illustrator for children's books. But the thing she really wanted to do was to sculpt. But also around this time, she invented a self-playing violin using magnetic tape loops and magnetic tape instead of like the horsehair on a bow. It's not something that I have a full understanding of, but it allowed her to use the violin in her work in ways that were much more easier for her to kind of manipulate. And she performed her first major performance art piece called Duets on Ice, in which she is wearing a pair of ice skates that are frozen in a block of ice while playing the violin. And the piece ends when the block of ice melts. So the violin, even though she sort of abandoned, you know, classical styles of playing the violin when she was young, when she was around 16, the violin would remain something that is very, very important to her. And the violin is on this record, and it would become important to how she experimented with and kind of pioneered new music technology. It was very much her way into music. And so I think that, you know, with this album, you're always going to bring to it your own personal sort of anxieties. This is an album about technology, I think, on its face. But there's the feminist musicologist called Susan McLary. She's, you know, pioneering feminist musicology. She's fantastic. And she wrote about Laurie Anderson at a time when people in the musicological academy were not engaging with her work. And she says that her work always involves several discourses, all operating simultaneously, all interconnected and unpredictable, sometimes contradictory ways. And she goes on to talk about how the academic musicians who know how to talk about music have little interest in Anderson's work. So you had the art world who very much embraced Laurie Anderson and very much saw her as a pioneer, but in the musical world, not, you know, popular music discourse or rock discourse, but in the actual, you know, academy of musicologists, there was very little engagement with her work. And, you know, McLary's idea, and I think I agree, is that because Laurie Anderson is doing something so different with her music, that it is, we need to find new questions to ask within the academy about what it is that she's doing and what it is that she's implying with her work, how it is that she's working tonally, what she's doing with playing within the Western canon and trying to deconstruct it. So that's Susan McLary piece. You can find it. It's really, really interesting for anyone particularly who has knowledge, much more knowledge than I do, of kind of Western tonality and Western art music and how she's a pioneer within that. So I would recommend reading that. But when people do talk about Laurie Anderson, it is often, and about this album in particular, it's often talked about in a kind of a man versus machine dichotomy. And I think that this can be a problem, because I think that it ignores the presence of machines on the album in itself. You know, there's a definite anxiety there about humanity and machine, but it shouldn't go without comment that Laurie Anderson is not a man. And this is an album. It is a collaboration between a woman and machines. And I think that this is what makes this album so interesting for the time that it came out. And one of the reasons why I wanted to choose it was because of its importance in understanding the history of technology as being written as a male pursuit and as something that men have conquered, when in actuality we know now that many of the early pioneers of technology and music technology were in fact women. So I think, you know, all of these questions and all of these discourses and ideas are all kind of wrapped up in this album, and it's wonderful. And so, I mean, she says, Anderson herself says, it's true that there's a lot of alienation in songs like Big Science and Oh Superman. All of my work that deals with machines and how they talk and think is inherently critical. But I think many people have missed an important fact. These songs themselves are made up of digital bits. My work is expressed through technology. A lot of it depends on 15 million watts of power. So I think now is probably a good time to actually hear what the album sounds like. So I guess there's no better place to start than at the beginning, the opening of From the Air, where we first hear her voice and the manipulation of her voice and this, you know, relatively benevolent but kind, all-knowing narrator that is very present throughout the whole album. So yeah, here's the opening of From the Air, the first track on Big Science. I think, you know, what a wonderful way to open this record. It really defies expectations when you hear that opening, that instrumental opening. You're really not sure what direction this is going to go in, and then this voice appears, this very this authoritative, slightly mechanical voice kind of appears, but very identifiable as a female voice, if not a human voice. So there's a kind of a femininity technology, you know, relationship happening here that I think is really really interesting. And it's also like there's kind of humor in this album as well, and I think you can definitely hear it from the air. You know, I think that is a song that deals with absurdity. The absurdity of you know, apocalypse, the absurdity of being, you know, you would assume on a plane, having the captain telling you to put your head in your knees, put your hands in your head, put your hands in your hips. It's this kind of Simon Says thing, and it's kind of questioning and complicating our relationship with authority. Like, why do we do the things that authority figures tell us to do? And it is because we believe that they will keep us safe and that they have our best interests at heart. And she is kind of absurdly kind of picking these ideas apart. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think that question of like complicity in authoritarian structures or regimes, or, you know, our fear of surveillance. There's a part later on in that track where the narrator or the voice is saying, I've got eyes in the back of my head, which is a kind of a, you know, a panopticon sort of image of constant surveillance that is, you know, was definitely part of the cultural conversation of the time in the early 1980s, but we can really, really, we can really understand it more greatly as time goes on. This, like, in 2024, this voice feels, I think, more familiar than ever, you know?
Yeah, very current.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there's a moment on Big Science as well, when this voice that sort of seems to exist above us in time and space instructs us to actually, we might just play it, hopefully we'll get to the part, but if we play Big Science, maybe jump in a little bit.
It's cold.
So you can kind of hear the absurdity there, you know, turn right where they're going to build that big shopping mall. There's a moment later where the voice is saying, I think we should put some mountains here. Otherwise, what are the characters going to fall off of? Mm. And there is also lyrics in the song, this juxtaposition and this critique, I think, of like the idea of American individualism, where the voice is saying, every man for himself, all in favor, say I. And that juxtaposition is in itself absurd and ridiculous. And yet there is, like, you know, such a great truth in that as an American ideal. And I love that song. I love Big Science. I think a lot of the absurdity in it comes from the, you know, Anderson kind of embodying this very detached character of a machine observing humans or planning the world for humans. There's something like really benevolent, but also kind of beautiful. And I think, you know, I always return to this idea of this album being a commentary on our relationship, or one of the commentaries being our relationship between femininity and particularly motherhood and technology. And I think that the, you know, we obviously have to get to Superman. what better time than now? But I mean, we can hear it alluded to on Oh Superman, where we hear this unknowable machine claim in its message. So, I mean, the setup for Oh Superman is, this is, you know, an answering machine message being left for you, for somebody, by this kind of mechanical voice. And this mechanical voice says in its message, this is your mother. Are you there? So, yeah, maybe we'll listen to a little bit of Oh Superman. Okay.
Oh Superman, oh John, if you want to leave a message, just start talking at the sound of the tone. Hello? This is your mother. Are you there?
So, Oh Superman is a... How long is it? 8 minutes, 25.
8.5 minutes.
8.5 minutes, and... You know, it opens with, oh, Superman, oh, Judge, oh, Mom and Dad. And I think, you know, there's a lot of ways you can interpret those ideas. Like, I mean, Superman being part of the very kind of mainstream America, like being a mainstream American icon or idol, but also being something heroic, something that, you know, has the capacity to save you. And so is, you know, the judge, whether that's God or whether that's, you know, the American legal system or something else. And then mom and dad, you know, also being these kind of, you know, these American figures, this part of this kind of idealized American family, but also signifying safety. And when you start complicating the relationship between a person and their mom and dad by bringing technology into it, I think it can get really, really interesting. Margaret Atwood wrote a piece in The Guardian about hearing a Superman for the first time on the radio. Sorry, the piece isn't about that, but she mentions it. And she says, "What I just heard wasn't funny. This is your mother," says a chirpy Midwestern voice on an answering machine. "Are you coming home?" But it isn't your mother. It's the hand that takes. It's a construct. It's something out of a sci-fi movie, such as Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It looks human, but it's not human, which is both creepy and sinister. Worse, it's your only hope. Mom and dad and God and justice and force having proved lacking. That piece in The Guardian is really, really fascinating. She kind of talks about, you know, gaining a lot of confidence through listening to Laurie Anderson's music, even while she was writing The Handmaid's Tale. She's like a really, you know, massive fan of hers. And I think the pair of them became friends kind of later in life as well. And
there is a picture of them, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, right, to go back into academia again for a second, sorry, it's who I am. Susan McClary, who I mentioned earlier, she says...
Don't ever change.
She says about Anderson, she says, "When Anderson involves herself with electronics, she confuses habits of thought grounded in gender difference, for it is supposed to be man who gives birth to and tames the machine." And the idea is that, you know, yet here is Laurie Anderson, you know, collaborating and inventing, but also fearing and loving these machines. And I think that the relationship between woman and machine is very different to what we can't come to understand as a relationship between man and machine. In Anderson's work, I think it's complicated with this kind of tactile, circular, maternal relationship. Woman and machine are both in themselves kind of in opposition to man as well, you know, man versus machine, but also woman kind of stands outside of man as being something that is differentiated by gender, differentiated by sex. And so, you know, we have constructed it as being an opposition. So woman and machine therefore kind of make for a strange kind of allyship, I think, on this album, a kind of a collaboration, and not in opposition to man necessarily. I mean, I don't even feel a lot of I don't feel that the work is addressing men directly in this at all. It's almost like the relationship between man and machine doesn't exist. That this is something more primal or more natural and therefore scarier, you know. And the mom in Oh Superman is kind of literally reconstructed in the song as a machine, you know, later on in the song, where it kind of turns a bit, you know, simultaneously more beautiful in terms of the music that you're hearing, but also more frightening in terms of the lyrics that you're hearing. The lyrics say, "So hold me, mom, hold me in your long arms, in your automatic arms, in your electronic arms, your petrochemical arms, your military arms." And obviously military arms being a play on words, but that, you know, I think here you get a really interesting sense of masculinity and technology being one and the same thing, the logical ending to a relationship between people and machines is the military. And that's kind of always where we end up. We always end up using technology to find ways to destroy one another. And I think, I don't know, I feel like on this album, it's not necessarily like a manifesto for something different. It's just, it deals in eventualities and foregone conclusions, I think. And like, I think that gender is a really interesting way to kind of to look at this. Like, even when she was performing United States 1-4, she took on this very like androgynous styling on stage. On the cover of this album, she's got, you know, short cropped hair, she's wearing, you know, bright white sunglasses. Her gender isn't being performed or constructed in any kind of very obvious way. And she didn't, while on stage, you know, kind of perform in a very traditional sense. Like, we don't get a sense of her emotional involvement with the music. She's not dancing necessarily, although there is sometimes movement. She's not necessarily showing us that she's having a good time or a bad time. She is, you know, at one with the performance. She is kind of an instrument. Her body is an instrument. Her voice is an instrument. And it is in collaboration with the technology that she has on stage with her. And she says about her performances, she says, "I wear audio masks in my work, meaning electronically I can be this shoe salesman or this demented cop or some other character. And I do that to avoid the expectations of what it means to be a woman on stage." And I think that quote is really interesting, that she wants to defy expectations of what it is to be a woman on stage. And she does that by wearing masks and by manipulating her voice and playing characters. And some of these characters are male and some of these characters are female. But she is not, it is not the Laurie Anderson show. She's kind of acting more like an actor in a one-woman play or a one-person play, as opposed to come along to the Laurie Anderson concert and hear the big hits. You know what I mean? Like, when I was talking to Claire Beck about this album on the podcast, she was saying that Laurie was supposed to come and do a show here before COVID happened. And I was like, "Oh my God, what do you think it was going to be?" And she was like, "Look, I don't think it was going to be the hits. I don't think we were all going to go and hear Oh Superman and sing along." It's more of like whatever it is that she's experiencing at the time. And, you know.
Yeah, I'm just looking here now what it said. It was a residency at National Concert Hall, The Language of the Future, ongoing project from her three concerts.
And she loves, you know, kind of these, you know, very avant-garde projects, I suppose you'd call them. She was an artist in residence at NASA for a while. They decided they wanted an artist in residence at NASA. And obviously they were like, Laurie Anderson should be it. And so she went and she wasn't sure what she was going to do. And she didn't really know what that meant. And so she ended up writing a piece about the moon. I can't remember what it was called. It was called something like The End of the Moon or something like that. I'll try and find it. But then there was criticism, as you can imagine. I mean, it wasn't a very accessible piece to the public. It was an art piece, and they should have known what they were getting when they got Laurie Anderson. But it was thought by the government then that actually extraneous spending on an artist in residence at NASA was not something that they wanted to include in their budget. So they got rid of the position. So I think she was the first and only artist in residence at NASA.
Fair play. Insight to that, there's a quote actually about her coming to Dublin, and it's quite nice. "Being at least quarter Irish, and who really knows how much more, I've always felt at home in Dublin. It's the only city I know where everyone uses the language as an art form. And I mean, starting with the taxi driver who picks you up at the airport, we begin the language dance, the put on the shaggy dog, the put upon heaven."
That's so beautiful. Oh, I think that's true. I mean, I hear people say that about how Irish people speak, that we speak in a kind of in a very musical way. It's hard for us to know, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Cute.
And I mean, she also...
Nice, gives good quote anyway.
Yeah, she does. And that's the thing about her. Like, so I'm talking about her here as this, you know, this very serious artist dealing with these very serious things. But when you watch interviews with her, she's extremely friendly and forthcoming, and she'll answer questions about her work. And, you know, if someone puts an idea to her, like, is Oh Superman about this, or is Big Science about this, or is this what you were trying to say? She'll really entertain the idea. And she doesn't seem to me, anyway, from the interviews that I've seen, very closed off and very, you know, well, I like to let the work speak for itself. She seems to actually want to engage in conversation with people about her work and about the work that she's doing. So she's not, even though I would be so intimidated if I was to ever meet her, she doesn't at all seem like an intimidating figure. And I wasn't going to mention this in the podcast, but I was watching just before we jumped on to start recording. She did a series of concerts for dogs. So she has a dog herself, or at least had a dog. I'm not sure if the dog is still with us, called Lola Bell. And I just came across this picture of Lola Bell on a stage beside a laptop with her paw on a keyboard, performing her first concert exclusively for dogs back in 2010.
Perform to be registered at a frequency that dogs hear best.
Yeah. There's a couple of video clips. I'll send you a video clip here and maybe we can play a little bit of it. Just one second. So this is a video taken in New York.
How old is Oliver?
He's about 4. He just had his birthday.
And this is his first gig?
This is his first gig, yes. Yeah, his entree into society.
Earlier than my first gig.
What's she doing in this bag?
Trying to stay warm. And she's hoping she hears some good sounds tonight.
Here in the audience, you can't really hear anything. Just a sort of low murmur. But I put my headphones on. Oh, and you can hear that Laurie Anderson's playing the violin. It's all coming through. So perhaps this is what the dogs are hearing, who knows? What kind of music does Clover normally listen to?
Normally WQXR or BBC Radio 3.
Oh, wow. So it's sort of classical.
Yeah, more classical.
I didn't, you know, this is really a dog walking area, Times Square exactly. So I was amazed that so many people actually got their dogs here. Because it's a cold night to walk. If you have a little dog, get him barking, okay? Come on, guys. This is your turn.
It's such a gorgeous piece, you know. So
that's a good one.
For listeners, it looks like it's kind of in the middle of winter. Everyone's all wrapped up. The dogs have their little coats on. And people have been given some headphones so that they will hear an approximation of what the dogs are hearing. I believe she's playing at a different frequency that they can hear and that we can't.
I hope so.
And they all seem like they're enjoying it. Maybe they're enjoying the music. Maybe they're enjoying being out on walks, being around other dogs. Who knows?
But love the dogs.
It's beautiful.
All sitting very patiently in Times Square.
We should say every one of them, good boy and good girl to all of them. And
of course.
Yeah, and then Laurie has her own dog as well, who she loves very much. And so this is the kind of woman that she is, you know, like she is thinking about things in different ways. She's thinking, well, why shouldn't we do a concert for dogs? We love dogs. We spend a lot of our time with dogs. There are, for many people, our companion, for some people, their primary companion. Why shouldn't we kind of bring them to hear a concert? And why shouldn't we make music for them? So she's not this like... she doesn't come across as the towering figure that she actually is. You know, she comes across as like quite a normal artistic woman who is just interested in doing things differently. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So
So I wanted to talk about Walking Falling, which is a short song on this album. Maybe we'll take a listen to it and then we'll have a chat about it.
I wanted you. And I was looking for you all day. But I couldn't find you. I couldn't find you. You're walking, and you don't always realize it, but you're always falling. With each step, you fall forward slightly, and then catch yourself.
So I've done hypno kind of therapy before. That's very hypnotherapy
adjacent. Oh, really?
Stuff there, yeah. People leading you into an imaginary place in your mind and thinking down at your subconscious. That's very hypnotherapy, therapeutic.
Yeah, I love Walking Falling because, again, I think there is again, that absurdity, that kind of, that detached character of a machine, like observing humans is what I take from it. Like there's something about her voice observing how walking works, you know, like that this is what walking is. With each step, you fall forward slightly, then you catch yourself from falling over and over. And it makes me think of like maybe an artist or an animator, like first trying to animate what it looks like for a human body to walk and how difficult it can be to make something that we do every day actually look natural when you're animating it or when you're creating it within some kind of computer program without like stepping into the uncanny. Or maybe this machine is trying to, you know, study us so that they might replicate us so that they can kind of reproduce our movements, you know, digitally or mechanically. And I think all of these things can be true at once, or it reminds me of a mother or a parent kind of looking upon their child doing something like walking, like taking their first steps and seeing it, you know, in this completely new way. And I mean, you as a new father, yeah. I'm sure you've experienced this, looking at the baby, you know, breathing or smiling or just doing things that we all do in our day-to-day lives, but it's like you're seeing it for the first time. Do you know what I mean? Is that something that, like,
yeah, it's absolutely captivating just watching somebody learn how to exist and just doing the things that we take for granted.
Yeah.
It's really special, actually. It's really, and you know, especially the milestone stuff, it's like, yeah, I mean, he's not even walking and falling yet, but he is, you know, he's holding himself up a tiny bit, or he's, you know, but his legs aren't strong enough, or, you know, he's smiling the last couple of weeks, but he hasn't started laughing just yet, but he is doing the laugh. All those kind of things. It's just like, yeah, the milestones of human endeavor is so interesting.
Yeah.
Like it's a real reminder every day that, you know, there's certainly more important things happening in the world than whatever it is you're doing probably right then and there without your child. It's really just like absolutely fascinating. You're like, wow.
Yeah.
It's so elemental and foundational that like you can't help but be impressed by it almost. And you're like, we all did this. And, you know, it's something we've talked about actually. I know I'm just ranting here about fatherhood now. And
no,
I'm just being a parent, but like, you're like, God, how did our parents not like just talk about us all the time when we were like, as in like, do you know what you were like? I mean, I know a lot of people are like that, but you know, like, you're like, God, you don't really appreciate what your parents did for you until really you're like, oh God, I have to look after one myself now. And like, this is mad.
But we sort of hate
this is mad
that
what you have to
or
do.
Or people, you know, especially in our adolescence, we sort of hate that. We hate hearing like, oh, when you were a baby, you used to do this. And there's always something so kind of embarrassing about being seen and being known in a way that you weren't conscious of or that you don't have a memory of. And that is something that is, you know, so defining about the parent-child relationship, that they have seen you learn and they have seen you become a person in a way that there is no way for us to know ourselves in that kind of more primal early stage of development. We only know ourselves when we have been developed by them and by society and by everything else. And so I think, you know, the walking, falling thing, like I'm not a parent myself, but it always makes me think of that feeling of, you know, when you're watching a child learn to walk and they walk and they fall, but eventually they don't fall and they keep walking. But when you're walking, that's what you're doing. You're walking and falling. And so it just makes me think of this real connection between who we are as children and as babies and as learners of how to exist, and that we're never really grown. We never really leave that stage. We're always still a little teeny bit falling when we walk, and, you know, kind of stumbling. And I really like that in this song, because while there is still, you know, as I mentioned, that, you know, the potentiality of it being a machine or something that wants to replicate us or something that is studying us in this very kind of detached way, I think that here, nearly more than anywhere else, there's a reverence for like how the human body works and the human spirit works, and, you know, the idea of marveling at a child in the same way that this machine is marveling at humans. And she said in an interview, everything, when you break it down, is bizarre and unlikely. And when I read that, or when I heard her say that in that interview, I immediately thought of this song, you know, how she breaks things down, something as simple as walking, into it being, you know, this miracle, this, you know, this bizarre thing that we've learned to do, to walk upright on two legs, and to, you know, just kind of walk around our days like not like taking it for granted as something that we do until you have a child, or you see a child, or, you know, if you have your own child and you see them learning to do these things for the first times, they become miracles again, and they feel like miracles again. And I think that's a really, yeah, it's a short song, but it's like there's kind of so much in it, like, and like all the songs on this are like that, like there's just so much to kind of think about. And like the themes that I am taking from this are like, might be completely different from the themes that somebody else might take from this. Somebody else might listen to Walking and Falling and not necessarily hear it as something hopeful or jubilant about the human race, and might hear it as being something a bit more anxiety inducing. But I mean, it's, you know, I know someone who heard that song while they were tripping, and it at first was a very comforting thing for them while they were kind of, you know, hallucinating and losing themselves. But then it became something much more frightening and scary. And this is not an album I would recommend listening to while tripping, certainly not if you're a first timer. But it's, because I think it can probably be absolutely terrifying. I've never done it myself, but like, there's just kind of so much of that stuff to unpick, and you can come back to it at different stages in your life or different stages in the world and hear new things in it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Great. And what about like then the rest of the album towards the end? What are you thinking?
Yeah. So I think like the themes in this album are, I think, you know, the relationship between people and technology and machinery, but it's also about loneliness. It's about trust. It's about institutions. And I think something that we didn't mention about Oh Superman was that it had kind of two, it was a hit kind of twice. The first time it was a hit because John Peel heard it and got in touch with Laurie Anderson, was like, I need you to send me like a lot of copies of your record. And then it was sold a lot in the UK. He played it a lot on his show. And it was, I think it was voted by, oh, there was some magazine, it was voted their least favorite hit single of like 1982, because it is, you know, obviously like, and Peel would play it in full on his radio show, which is, you know, we don't have DJs who are allowed to do stuff like that anymore. But anyway, later in 2001, she was playing a gig. I believe it was the night of 9/11. And
in and around, I think.
Yeah, it was either the night of or it was the night after. And she was in New York, and there's a line in Oh Superman, this is the hand that takes, here comes the planes, they're American planes made in America. And then it moves back to smoking or non-smoking. And she played this town hall in New York City, sorry, 1 week after 9/11. She says, as I sang, here come the planes, they're American planes, I suddenly realized I was singing about the present. And so this song became, you know, it didn't have a major return into the public consciousness in terms of thinking about 9/11. But for the people who were at that gig and for fans of hers, those lines really kind of resonated. Here come the planes, they're American. Like, here come the planes, you know, being the planes that hit the two towers, but then the American planes that are eventually sent out to the Middle East for the war on terror. Like, you can really read and unpick this song as a moment of, you know, almost clairvoyance when it comes to kind of American, the American military. And it's so unclear, like, even now, how you can kind of reasonably read the meaning of those lines without taking into account our current context, for example, with like, you can hear here come the planes, they're American planes, in terms of, you know, aid packages being sent to Israel right now. Obviously, during the war on terror, like, they're the most kind of overtly political lines, I think, on the record. And it's incredible to me how poignant they still feel. Like, when I was listening to it this morning in my headphones, here come the planes, they're American planes, I was just thinking about that aid package to Israel and just the ubiquity of American planes in almost every war that's been fought in the world before and since this song was written, you know. And she said there was an interview after she performed it in 2001. People said, you know, how'd you predict the future? As if that war was not the exact same war and had never stopped. It's just chopped up and advertised in different ways. And yeah, so I mean, back to your question of, like, you know, the themes of the album, I think that this is an album that will always feel resonant, and not just for Oh Superman, although I do feel that that song will always feel resonant and becomes more and more resonant as time goes by, not just in terms of, like, the military industrial complex of the United States, but also because of the, you know, it kind of grows and stretches to accommodate whatever techno anxieties we're actually experiencing in the time that we're living in. And, like, the time we're living in now seems to be filled with the predicted concerns of this album, our relationship with machines, with controlling those machines, with the collaboration between those machines and humans, in not only in warfare, but in literature and in art. She has, you know, thinking about the advent of AI and thinking about ChatGPT and the so-called collaboration between humans and machines that happens when you create kind of, like, digital AI art. You can tell that you can tell my feelings about that. But she in her practice is also kind of growing to accommodate this. I don't think that she has engaged yet, and I'm not sure if she will, in kind of AI technologies or the ones that we kind of understand them as now. But she has experimented with things like virtual reality. So, like, I don't see her shying away from the world of AI, but I also would be very surprised if she engaged with AI in ways that are currently familiar to us. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I would expect her to be, you know, as anxious and cautious of this technology as she is of other technologies that we can hear on Big Science. So, like, you know, thematically, it's all here. It's like the human experiences here, but especially the kind of the 20th and 21st century human experience. You know, she's born in the 1950s. She's born at a time when fear of nuclear bombs is rife. She's growing up in the 1960s during the Vietnam War. Like, machinery and technology and the potential for technology to win out is something that is so part of her experience of growing up in America. And there's also the experience of growing up in America during a time of, you know, increased commercialization and consumerism and kind of neoliberal ideas about individuality and every man for himself, all in favor, say I. Like, it is a political album. It is a human album. It is a technological album. It is a marvel to listen to. Like, this album was released in the early 1980s, uses vocoders, uses synthesizers, uses a lot of music technology, and doesn't at all sound dated. It sounds new and clean and crisp. And her voice on the album is so, you know, it's just, it's so close, and it speaks directly to you. Do you know? It's really affecting. It's really kind of ponderous, and you could just spend hours talking about it and thinking about it. And I'll stop there lest I go on too much about how amazing it is. But I mean, I think this is the album I'm the most excited to hear in the room. I'm the most excited to hear it on the system, just to hear how it sounds with that crackle, you know, and we're in that room with all that incredible technology, and it's analog and it's digital. And, you know, it just feels like the perfect space to kind of think about these things.
This is
going to
sound wonderful.
It's going to sound amazing. Absolutely. It's going to sound so good. There's also bagpipes on this album that we didn't mention, but maybe we'll keep those as a surprise on the night.
Well, you've just ruined it now.
And does the copy that you have Walk the Dog on it as the last track? Because that's actually I think a bonus track on the album, so I'm not sure if all of the LPs will have Walk the Dog.
I don't have it right, it's actually inside, I think,
so we'll find out on the night.
Will I go have a look? Yeah.
But yeah, Walk the Dog is a really sweet song. Let X Equal X is a song that I haven't spoken about, but I think that's a really beautiful and poignant, but also a little bit scary song. It's all just so good. Like, I don't know if the things that I've spoken about here were things that you experienced while listening to it. Like, you might have had a completely different set of discourses and ideas kind of come up for you lyrically or musically.
I think it's just it feels like it just feels all contemporary still as well, mm-hmm. in terms of production and music, and I think that's really interesting. And then
I can hear in Rachel Lavelle's kind of little spoken word moments in some of her tracks, I can really hear a Laurie Anderson kind of inflection, do you know?
Yeah, it is that kind of like avant-garde, is that the right term for it?
I think so. More, yeah, like, I think we use that term for so many things, but I think it is genuinely avant-garde. Yeah,
it talks about, you know, it's a dissection of 80s America at the time. It's got like this, it's got that spoken word stuff in it that it leads you down different paths. And it's very, you know, it's not a pop album, but it's lots of pop sounds on it as well. Mm. And Oh Superman in particular is like, I mean, it is a fantastic song. And it is, like I said to you, the thing I knew about this album the most. So I was really excited to kind of go and listen to more of it. Mm. And I kind of understand where it's coming from. And I do think the art background really helps you understand that as well. Mm. So knowing that it comes from that multimedia art piece, United States 1-4, does really help.
Yeah, because it's not, like, I think usually when we talk about albums, we can try to root them in a kind of a popular music history. You know, like, Laurie is someone who was hanging around in New York, like, with the Talking Heads. She was married to Lou Reed. Like, she's someone who was friends with a lot of musicians, but there's absolutely no way that you would know. Like, it's so hard to pinpoint musical influences that she had on this album. And I think that's because she came to it from a completely different background. she didn't come to this from having a background in popular music or having a background. Like she had a background in playing the violin, so she understood tonality and she had an understanding of that instrument. But when it came to her practice, when it came to her actually making this album, she's very much approaching it from a performance art aspect. And I think that's why it's so hard to pinpoint it, like its place within popular music history in terms of the things that have influenced it. Do you know what I mean? Like the synthesizers and the technology that she's using, she seems to be using because that was available to her in her art practice, as opposed to being available to her in a musical practice,
And I think that really does shine through when you listen to it. Super, super interesting. If you want to come along to the Laurie Anderson Big Science Listening Party, and there's about half of the tickets left now at the moment. I think there's about 20 or so. It's a small enough event. Tickets are limited to 40. So they went on sale yesterday, which is Tuesday or Wednesday as we're speaking today. So by the time you hear this, 2 days ago. So get on it. Laurie Anderson, Big Science. It's the Niler 9 Eventbrite page, or there's tickets are available on the site from a tenner each. Do have a look and consider buying them because they do sell out as they're so small. It's such a small, lovely room. As we said, Wednesdays, the last Wednesday of every month. So we haven't decided what we're even doing next. So I'm excited now to do this one and see what comes down the line. Certainly. Do you know what I was surprised by? The book, the 1001 Albums to Listen to Before You Die. This wasn't in it.
You're currently really propped up on it because I don't have my computer monitor doesn't have a stand, and you're currently propped up on David Byrne's How Music Works and my copy of 1001 Albums to Hear Before You Die. Yeah, it's not in it. And this is what I mean.
Maybe they move it around. I don't know. But it's certainly not the copy I have. So
like, and also I just want to give a shout out to a book I read last year as part of my research for a conference I was doing called Pink Noises, Women on Electronic Music and Sound by Tara Rogers, who is electronic musician and academic in electronic music, feminist academic in electronic music. And there's obviously bits written about Laurie and her, how influential she was on electronic music. But it is a series of interviews and conversations with female electronic musicians that tries to address the lack of women in the history of music technology. It's really accessible. I think like maybe the first chapter or so is like quite academic, but even so, the language is very accessible. But the interviews in it are really, really fascinating. So I highly recommend that book for anybody who's interested in kind of that, you know, alternative feminist history of electronic music. It's fantastic.
Great. Lovely. Okay, brilliant. Right, that's it from us this week in terms of Big Science and the deep dive. Join us on the February 28th for the listening party in the Big Romance in Dublin, if you're around. Patreon.com/909 members get a 2-for-1 deal on those tickets as well. So another added bonus for them. Limited, obviously, because there's only a limited amount of tickets.
Yes.
But that's part of the fun. But yeah, do you know what? I'm going to play out because I won't be able to play it because what I love about the Big Romance is it's vinyl only, which is great. But sometimes it means like the albums we are playing, I don't have everything I'd like to have to play around it, because we always play tunes before and tunes afterwards. Mm-hmm. And if I had this on vinyl, if this exists on vinyl, I would be playing this. This is kind of the Italo disco-y edit of Oh Superman.
I've never heard this.
By
so
Marcello
looking forward to
Giordiani. So we'll leave you with this. All right, that's it from us. Bye.
Hi. I'm not home right now. But if you want to leave a message, just start talking at the sound of the train.
Fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.